Okay, great. So I'm going to be talking about Vajrapani and energy. And of course, yesterday we met two different forms of Vajrapani, which do look quite different, don't they? As Laura pointed out to us this morning. We've got this sort of raging, massive, stamping, deep blue, wrathful, flame-wreathed image. Who's supposed to be roaring. He's roaring this big sound of hum. You know, you can't miss him. And then we've got the peaceful form of Vajrapani, who's sitting in that very, very relaxed position and just balancing a Vajra on the palm of his hand. Total relaxation, effortless, smooth. And how are those two the same? How are those two totally different representations, both embodying the same mental state of virya or energy that is tending towards the good? So I'm talking about this in I've got four sections to the talk, so we're going to start off with looking at some sections of the Pali Canon. So those are the earliest records of the Buddha's teachings, and we're going to see how energy shows up for the Buddha. Then I'm going to have a look at what virya is and what laziness is. Quite like that bit. Then we're going to look at the qualities of the Vajra and how seeing with Vajra clarity might lead to that sense of energy. And then, to finish off, I'm going to have a quick look at the relationship between energy and effort, because I think that can be a particularly problematic area, particularly for people in the West. So that's where we're heading. Haha. Okay then, so this first sutta that we're going to take a look at is called the Padana Sutta, which means exertion. Now this is, it's like a dramatic monologue actually. So this is before the Buddha has got enlightened. So he isn't the Buddha at this point, he's Siddhartha Gautama. And he's left home, he's left his wife, his children, his beautiful palace, his parents, and he's gone off on this quest. And he's gone to all the leading spiritual teachers of his day and practiced their practices as far as it could take him, and he hasn't yet gained enlightenment. So what he's trying now is ascetic practice. So he's starving himself, and he's trying to meditate without breathing. So, you know, we do the mindfulness of breathing. He's trying to do meditating without breathing. And so it's like he doesn't actually quite know the way, but he's giving it his best shot. So we've got like this dramatic monologue. So first we've got the Buddha, and the Buddha says, "To me, resolute in exertion, near the river Naranjara, making a great effort, concentrated in meditation to attain rest from bondage, Mara came." Now we met Mara this morning, didn't we? So like these voices that come up and just say, call that a meditation or something like that. So Mara pops up next to the Buddha, and Mara is like the embodiment of everything, all the obstacles in the way of our attaining enlightenment. And we've already talked about Vajrapani as clearing obstacles, getting obstacles out of the way. So Mara came, speaking words of compassion. He's talking to the Buddha. "You are ashen and thin. Death is in your presence. Live, good sir. Life is better. Alive, you can do acts of merit. Your living the holy life, performing the fire sacrifice, will heap up much merit. What use is exertion to you? Hard to follow the path of exertion. Rough, difficult, and hard to bear." So he's basically saying, why don't you just go and do what everybody else does, which is like practice Brahmanism. That's what everyone else does. It's good enough for them. Why isn't it good enough for you? This is really, really hard going. you're going to die doing it. Why don't you just give up? Why don't you just give up? So then the Buddha might say, oh yeah, Mara, you've got a point. But actually, he doesn't. So what he says is, cousin of the negligent, evil one, come here for whatever purpose. I haven't for merit even the least bit of need. In me are conviction, austerity, persistence, discernment. Why, when I'm so resolute, do you petition me to live? The wind could burn up even river currents. Why, when I'm resolute, shouldn't my blood dry away? As my blood dries up, the mind grows clearer. Mindfulness, understanding, and concentration stand more firm. See a being's purity. And then he goes into this whole list where he's starting to use this sort of warfare metaphor, where he's still talking to Mara, and he says, sensual passions are your first army. Your second is called discontent, hunger and thirst, craving, sloth and drowsiness, terror, uncertainty, hypocrisy and stubbornness. That, Mara, is your army, the Dark One's commando force. And it's like he's saying, I'm totally determined. I'm developing all of these spiritual qualities. And then he says, I spit on my life. Death in battle would be better for me than that I, defeated, survive. So it's quite full on, isn't it? Like, it's quite full on. Basically, he's saying, I've set out on this quest to gain enlightenment. He's completely convinced that there is this state called enlightenment, even though nobody's realised it. And it's like, well, how does he manage that? And then he's saying, actually, my spiritual practice is more important to me than my life. It's quite a full-on thing to say. And he's completely confident. He says, seeing the bannered force on all sides, the troops, I go into battle. May they not budge me from my spot. That army of yours, that the world with all its gods can't overcome, I will smash with understanding, as with stone a raw clay pot. So it's like he's just these voices, and what basically what this is doing is it's sort of dramatizing what is happening inside Gotama's mind. And he's got these voices coming up saying, you can't do it, it's all pointless, give up, why don't you just go and live an easy life? And he says, no, I am going to do this. This is more important than whether I live or die, this spiritual quest. And you can see how that is quite, we might think that the wrathful Vajrapani is quite related to that. It's like, there he is sort of rampaging in, saying, here is my power, I am not giving up. However, do bear in mind that this is still Siddhartha Gautama. He's not the Buddha, this is not the enlightened mind, okay? He's still on the wrong track. And just what happens at the end of that sutta is Mara gets completely despondent, and he said, for 7 years I've dogged the Buddha's steps, but I haven't gained a single opening. He was overcome with sorrow. His lute fell from his arm. He's supposed to hold this sort of musical instrument, and he kind of plays these strains to try to persuade us to just go and, I don't know, do anything except practice the Dharma. And it says, his lute fell from under his arm, then he, the despondent spirit, right there disappeared. And actually, that's what happens when we notice our back row hecklers. We don't have to do anything else. All we have to do is say, I see you, Mara. That's quite often what the Buddha says. And then they just vanish. They have no power other than that, our own belief in them. Okay, so that's the first sutta. So what happens after this is basically the Buddha realizes that what he's doing is not working. He's been, you know, he's been practicing austerities harder than anyone he knows has ever practiced them, and it is getting him nowhere. And he realizes this. And so then he's describing this whole process of how he realizes what the actual path to enlightenment is. And he says, "I thought, I recall once as a child, when my father, the Shakyan, was working, and I was sitting in the cool shade of a rose apple tree. Then, quite secluded from sensuality, secluded from unskillful mental qualities, I entered and remained in the first dhyana, meditation, with rapture and pleasure born from seclusion, accompanied by directed thought and evaluation. I thought, could that be the path to awakening? Then following on that memory came the realization, that is the path to awakening. I thought, so why am I afraid of that pleasure that has nothing to do with sensuality, nothing to do with unskillful mental qualities?" And he realizes there's nothing the matter with pleasure, and he realizes that this relaxed moment when he was just sitting in the shade of a tree, not doing anything in particular, and he naturally went into meditation, that was the way to enlightenment. And then what happens is he starts to eat again, and his companions desert him in disgust, thinking, "Gotama the contemplative is living luxuriously. He's eaten some rice and porridge." And then he goes off and sits under the Bodhi tree and tries this new method where he's meditating with the same determination that he was bringing to his ascetic practices. So when he sits down there, he still says, "I will not stir from this spot until I am enlightened." He's got that level of determination, and he just says, "This is what I'm going to do." But with this ease and this relaxation, and both those things together mean that he sits under that tree and his mind opens and he becomes the Buddha, the awakened one. And the rest is history. And we can probably see that the second extract that I just read, the one about the rose apple tree and the relaxation, is much more like the peaceful Vajrapani, that relaxed attitude, that holding, you know, that very delicate holding of the Vajra. So it's like we can see what these two forms of Vajrapani are embodying. We can see them right from the start, right in kind of like the energy used by the Buddha to get enlightened. Okay. So that's just something actually that we might want to carry on thinking about, as in like, where in our lives do we have relaxation and where in our lives do we have determination? Are they different? Are they the same? And it is quite a good question, actually, asking what place does warrior energy have in the spiritual life? And hopefully some of the rest of the talk will help explore that. Okay, so now we're going to have a look at what virya, what energy in pursuit of the good actually is, and look at laziness and what that is and what we can do about it. So, virya, so Sangharakshita in Know Your Mind, which is a fantastic book, okay? Know Your Mind, an amazing book by Sangharakshita. Banti describes virya as being not only energy in pursuit of the good, but he describes it as like an intentness on or a powerful inclination towards the skillful. And what I think is quite interesting about that is it's not just about energy in terms of kind of like, I don't know, a Formula One racing car or something like that. It's this inclination, it's this desire in us, a deep desire in us to want to move towards what is positive, what will help us grow, what's skillful. And in a way, the energy is the result of that rather than of itself, if you see what I mean. Like, energy is what naturally arises if we have this powerful inclination towards the good.
Could it also be described as resolve? Or is it different to resolve?
I think resolve would be slightly different, but it definitely has an aspect of that, doesn't it? That sort of directed, this is the direction that I want to go in. And not in a kind of head theory way, but in a kind of heart and guts way. I mean, Vajrapani is really guts. I don't know if you've noticed this when chanting Vajrapani's mantra, but it's like where you feel it is your belly. You know, someone like Green Tara, you feel it in your heart area, or you know, different places. But Vajrapani gets you in the guts. Okay, so that's Virya. So we'll probably also understand a bit what it is when we go on to three types of laziness. I really like the three types of laziness.
Can we bother to talk about them?
I can definitely be bothered to talk about them. So the first type of laziness is quite simply, it's the laziness of laziness. So this is like, we wake up in the morning and we think, I could meditate. And I think, nah, we just turn over. Sometimes it can be just like, you know, our energy isn't available. Everything's like a massive effort. And sometimes it's just like, we can't be bothered. We really can't be bothered. Okay, I'm going to read you another. This is a talk of three suttas, but this is such a gorgeous sutta, I couldn't possibly leave it out. And also, I think what I like about it as well is it sort of shows that, you know, I can kind of think, yeah, back in the Buddha's day, all the monks and the nuns, they were really into it and they were all really hardcore spiritual practitioners. Well, I don't think the Buddha would have been saying all this if that was the case. So, monks, there are these eight grounds for laziness. There is a case where a monk has some work to do, very appropriate for a work retreat. The thought occurs to him, I will have to do this work, but when I have done this work, my body will be tired. Why don't I lie down? So he lies down. He doesn't make an effort for the attaining of the as yet unattained, the reaching of the as yet unreached, the realization of the as yet unrealized. This is the first grounds for laziness. Then there is the case where a monk has done some work. I'm sure we can all relate to that. We've all done some work today. The thought occurs to him, I have done some work. Now that I have done work, my body is tired. Why don't I lie down? So he lies down. He doesn't make an effort for the attaining of the as yet unattained, etc., etc., etc. Then there is the case where a monk has to go on a journey. The thought occurs to him, I will have to go on this journey, but when I have gone on the journey, my body will be tired. Why don't I lie down? There is the case where a monk has gone on a journey. He thinks, after I have been on this journey, my body is tired. He has the thought, why don't I lie down? Anyhow, it carries on like this. You get the gist, don't you? And the point is, every situation this unfortunate monk meets, he has the thought, why don't I lie down? So what I love about this sutta is it's this situation where it doesn't matter what the circumstances of our life are, we can always have the thought, why don't I lie down? I can meditate tomorrow. I can practice ethics tomorrow. There's always, you know, no matter what the situation of our life, we can always think, now's not the moment. Maybe tomorrow, or maybe next week, or maybe when my job's next busy, less busy, or when my lodger's moved out, or how about when I retire? And of course, the next thing that will happen will be, well, how about after I've died? And then it all starts going a bit pear-shaped. So, anyhow, that was obviously a situation for the in the Buddha's day as well. So there's an antidote to this. There's a few antidotes. The antidotes come in various lists, and actually I'm not following any of them. I'm just picking a few that I fancy. So the antidote to the laziness of laziness could be delight and desire. So where do we have delight in our life? Where do we want to do this? Where do we want to meditate? Where do we want to practice? And actually, this is really crucial, finding pleasure in our spiritual life. Completely crucial. Because if we don't find pleasure in our spiritual life, we just won't do it. We absolutely won't do it, because that's where the motivation is. And you probably saw that in the rose apple tree section about the Buddha. And it was the moment when he realized that there was skillful pleasure, that pleasure could take us towards openness and awakening, was the moment that he made that breakthrough. So, okay, another good bit of Sangharakshita. Human beings are ruled to a great extent by pleasure, and we can't function well without it. If you haven't enjoyed anything for a long time, if you haven't experienced some thoroughgoing happiness and delight, you will tend to feel listless and drained of energy. So if you give up the pleasurable things of this life, you will have to replace them somehow. If you don't replace them with pleasures that will draw you towards a higher purpose, your energy will get stuck and may even force its way out in disagreeable ways. Unless you enjoy what you're doing, you can't do it in a very positive spirit for long. So, can we notice where we get deep pleasure in areas that also open us up? So for some of us, that might be meditation. But there can be a thing, you know, like I live with somebody over the way, and she says, I really enjoy meditation, but somehow I can never bring myself to do it. So there is a case for kind of like really reflecting on where we do get enjoyment, and then kind of thinking, yes, well, I'm going to go there. And there's pleasures that open us up, which might not be in meditation, which might be like going for a walk by ourselves. It might be looking at the sea, for those of us that live at Borth. You know, it might be making time for communication with good friends. You know, there's all those things. I've not yet heard somebody say, after an hour on Facebook, I felt really open and spacious. Now, one of you guys could be the first people to tell me this. But it really is worth noticing where we go for pleasure, and then does that thing actually give us what we would hope for? Do we feel better after it, or actually do we feel worse? Okay. So, that's about looking for pleasure. Another thing about this is look for painfulness. So I'll just say this quite briefly, but actually this is a sort of classic thing actually that I see on meditation retreats here sometimes, where somebody's in the shrine room and they're falling asleep all the time in meditation. And what can be a really helpful thing to do if you are feeling like there isn't any energy in your spiritual practice is think, okay, so where is the energy in your life? And quite often it's tied up in something painful in our lives. And it might be a relationship, it might be work, it might be anxiety about our health, you know, it might be all sorts of different areas. But actually, if we're leaving that part of ourselves outside the door with our shoes, we won't, that's where our energy is as well. So even if it feels like I want to be really spiritual and peaceful and calm and serene on this retreat, actually we need to invite in those difficult areas and explore, like, how does this area make me feel? Like, what does this painfulness feel like? Why is this so painful to me? Where do I feel this in my body? And by inviting these difficult areas in, we are also inviting our energy back into engagement with our practice. So, awareness, flames of transformation. Okay, so then we've got the laziness of busyness. Laziness of busyness, this is a very popular one, I think. According to Gampopa, who's a very famous Tibetan teacher back in about, I don't know, centuries ago, the ultimate form of laziness is making money and defeating our enemies. So we could think of that as business and politics, or we could think of it simply as putting a lot of energy in our lives into getting pleasures and avoiding discomfort. And there's actually a lot of social pressure to be busy. We're a worthwhile person if we're engaged in lots of different things, if we're running from this to that and we have lots of social engagements and this thing and that thing. Atisha, he's another Tibetan teacher, he says, there is never an end of things to do, so limit your activities. I say that to myself a lot. It's very simple, but actually laziness of busyness is about spending all our time being very, very busy in activities that are not of central importance to us. What is of the deepest importance and the deepest value? When we're on our deathbed, what do we want to look back and think, that is what I spent my life on? And is that where we actually spend our time? There can be this addiction kind of thing with activity. For me, I used to go running and climbing a lot, and I was definitely addicted. Instead, we could look at, could we get addicted to having an open and spacious mind? Could we have an urgent appointment to sit on a park bench and look at the sky? Could we make that a priority along the lines of, you know, all the other things that we have in our lives? So also an antidote to the laziness of busyness is just looking at how much we can persevere when our energy is engaged in worldly matters. So for instance, if we've ever got an educational qualification, if we've ever tried to maintain maybe a long distance relationship with a sexual partner, if we've ever tried to start up a business, all these different things where, in fact, they're difficult. Obstacle after obstacle happens, but yet we persevere, you know, we stick to it and we do it anyway. And can we have the clarity of sort of thinking, okay, so what is most deeply important to me? Can we have that clarity to bring that sort of determination and perseverance to maybe meditating when it's difficult, or practicing ethics when everybody around you thinks you're stupid? How would it be if we brought that kind of level of commitment and energy? This woman I used to know in Sheffield, and she could never get up to meditate in the morning. And then she fell in love. She got a boyfriend in the States, and suddenly she could get up at 6 every morning to have a phone conversation with this guy. Okay, so then the third sort of laziness, of self-contempt and despair. So I love it that self-contempt and despair is considered laziness. So every time we think, actually, I'm not good enough, I can't do it, I'm a hopeless meditator, actually, we're sort of sinking into this soft armchair, this comfortable armchair that's very, very difficult to get out of. But actually, we're letting ourselves sink into that. And it's like a sort of pride. It's a pride saying that we're special. So we are specially different. Everyone else can practice the Dharma, but not us. We can't do it. And it is easy to fall into. And I think self-contempt and self-pity is something that Mara very, very often pops up and says to us. So Buddha pride is an antidote to this. We can actually cultivate pride, which is a type of energy. We can even think... this is actually a traditional thing that is recommended. We can think, well, actually, all these other people, they're completely helpless. They're just kind of running with their negative emotions. But actually, I've got the power to do something about this. I can do this. I have the lion-like pride. I am a daughter of the conqueror. I can do this. I often think, actually, when meditating, this is something that I do. If I'm sitting there and I'm really, really distracted. And I could sit there and think, I can't meditate. But actually, what's more important? Is it me sitting there and having a good meditation? Or is it me breaking this habit of thinking that I can't do it? So, you know, we can just sit there and think, okay, we're not meditating. But actually, we can rejoice in what we do. We can just think, how amazing. Here am I, with a commitment to awareness and with a commitment to kindness. How fantastic. I'm sitting on this cushion with that commitment. How amazing. Most people in the world aren't able to do this, but I am doing this. And that is a positive sort of a pride. Okay, so that's the three types of laziness and a selection of antidotes. Okay, so now changing tack a little bit, we're going to look at what the qualities of the Vajra are. And in a particular way, you know, there could be an awful lot said about this. So we've got Vajrapani, holder of the Vajra, bearer of the diamond thunderbolt. Maybe in about 2 or 3 days' time, I got a phone call from my father saying that my mum had been taken into hospital and she died in 7 weeks. She was completely healthy. She got taken into hospital. She got diagnosed with colon cancer and it took her 7 weeks to die. So one way of looking at Vajra. So Vajra is this diamond thunderbolt that shatters the way in which we see things. And how we see things typically is we see people, things, ourselves, our bodies, houses, careers, whatever, as permanent, as able to give us satisfaction. As sort of inherently, you know, they're going to stay put, they're going to be there for us, they're going to give us what we want. So when we see what's called like the Vajra nature of everything, what we're seeing is impermanence, we're seeing transitoriness. And there's different aspects of that. There's seeing the beauty of it, like we were talking about those verses at the end of the Diamond Sutra, where we're seeing each one of us as a dewdrop or the reflection of the moon, maybe like a snowflake or something like that. Somebody in the community was talking about listening to Desert Island Discs, and I can't remember who it was on Desert Island Discs, but he was saying, these are the happiest years of my life. And the interviewer said, well, but your wife is dying of cancer. Like, why are these the happiest years of your life? And what he said was, it's because I'm seeing her as she truly is. So it's like in that situation, he dropped wanting his wife to be what he, you know, the sort of person he wanted her to be, and was just seeing her exactly as the unique, changing, transient, beautiful, full of potential human being that she was, with everything else dropped away. And that's why he was describing that as the happiest years of his life. That's kind of getting to the other side of it. So, seeing with a Vajra eye is seeing the nature of everything as energy, as flow and as potential. And it's like there's two sides to this. There's a withdrawal side and there's an engagement side. So the withdrawal side is like, it's like losing the intoxication with things that keep us stuck in maybe the laziness of busyness. Just like the Buddha left home and left his wife and his child. It's like we just cease to be intoxicated by, I mean, I just think of myself, you know, here am I, you know, ostensibly committed to a Dharma life, and actually it is very, very important to me. And then what happens, like I walk through the kitchen at Taraloka, somebody that I live with says something to me that I don't like very much, and then off I strop thinking, they said that, and don't they appreciate this, and don't they realise that I cleaned the such and such last week, and off I strop on this little thing. And actually, you know, I could spend most of my life in either in little strops about things that other people have said or done that I don't really like, or else in sort of like little cravings, like whether I can get the right sort of tea that I'm particularly fond of. And then I must say, I do have a bit of a thing about mugs. And then everybody else has used the mug that I want to use. And don't they know that that's my mug? That's my favourite bone china mug with the M on it. This is just getting embarrassing. That's what's scary about having people I hear that I live with. Yeah. Okay. So it's like there's a withdrawal aspect, and when the Buddha is sitting there, saying, the spiritual quest is more important to me than my life, he's sort of saying, all those other things are not the most important thing in my life. There's an image used in the White Lotus Sutra, which is of this world as like a burning house. So imagine that this building was on fire and the flames were licking at the beams, and we're like these children playing in the burning house with our toys, and we're so entranced by our toys or our bone china mugs with M on them, or that thing that the person said to us about cleaning the compost bin or whatever it might be, that actually we don't realise what's actually important, which is getting out of this house before it crashes around our ears. So it's like looking at what we have unrealistic expectations about, rather than there being a particular problem with any of these things. You know, there's nothing the matter with bone china mugs. But we do just have this deep emotional investment in things staying the same. And we think those are of value and are going to keep us safe. And I know I've talked about this before, but I'm going to tell you again. which is I had this very kind of full-on meditation experience quite a number of years ago now, where it's like, and I was just getting involved in the movement, so I've been meditating like maybe 18 months or something like that, and I went on a retreat, and I had this meditation where I just saw myself cuddling up in bed with my first boyfriend, and I said to him, "Will you love me forever? Will you keep me safe?" And he said yes, and then he just vanished and crumbled into dust. And then it was like the same thing with the boyfriend I had after that. "Will you love me forever? Will you keep me safe?" And he'd say yes and just crumble into dust. And then, you know, my partner that I was still with at that time, you know, very long, stable relationship, and I was, you know, in bed with this guy. "Will you love me forever? Will you keep me safe?" "Yes." And then he just vanished into dust. And it was just like, oh. That's, you know, oh. So that's the withdrawal aspect. It's losing our intoxication with what we think is permanent and ultimately satisfying, and it isn't. Now, if we only had the withdrawal aspect, basically, we'd either just become complete hedonists and kind of live for the moment, or else we'd completely think, well, I'll just go and top myself or something, you know. So we don't want just withdrawal. And the Buddha, you know, you can see that what he had combined with that was this complete faith that there was a state of enlightenment, that there was something beyond that, that something happened if you stepped outside of all that kind of like believing that things are solid, that something else happened. And we need that too. So that's the engagement aspect. And we've got another, from a different part of the Buddhist tradition, we've got another house image. And this is from the Pure Land tradition, which I'm very fond of. And it's about the spiritual life as leaving the woods and the gardens and going into a house. And we go deeper and deeper into the house until we enter the innermost room of the house. There we're enlightened, we're completely freed, but we don't stay there. We leave the house, we go back out through all those rooms, and we go back and we play in the garden of the senses and the forest of birth and death. So, you know, if the first one, the image of the burning house, is like, get out. You know, it's urgent, get out. And you can see we've got Vajrapani expressing this sort of spiritual impatience, like, don't wait, we're all going to die. You know, don't hang around, what else is worth doing? We've got Vajrapani wielding his Vajra, stomping, surrounded by flames, saying that. But then we've got this other image of moving back out into the world, into this garden of birth and death. And then we're free, we're playing, we're engaged in the world. And that's like the play and the lightness of peaceful Vajrapani. And I think we can actually get kind of, you know, I'm not enlightened and I'm not particularly thinking that anyone else in this room necessarily is, but it's sort of like as we move in that direction, I think we do get a sense of that. So, I mean, I think I get a sense of it in my relationships with people. I mean, my relationship with my mother dramatically changed from the point where I stopped wanting her to be the way I wanted her to be. And I started engaging with her as a human being who was conditioned just as I had my conditioning. There were reasons why she was behaving the way she was. And I was able just to relate to her as she was, rather than, I want my mum to be like this and you're not like this. That relationship completely changed. I mean, actually, I loved it when Janice was talking about, you know, how you've been talking about Calais and going to the jungle in Calais and then you coming back and talking from your heart to lots of different people about what that was like, stepping into that situation and engaging with the refugees from Syria. And then the sort of effect, the sort of heart-opening effect that that was then having on the people that you were then talking to. It's like your heart opening was transferring to their heart opening. And that's like, that is like you going into your inner room and then stepping back out into the garden of birth and death. You know, Emma, when you were talking about going into that men's prison, and, you know, metta as a weapon, and you, you know, being kind to these prisoners in there for all these different violent crimes. It's like that's you taking a sort of... That's you taking engagement and sense of potential and all that and stepping out into the garden of birth and death and giving that gift. And it's like the withdrawal and the engagement, they go together. You can't have one without the other. And this is, you know, anyway, this is how we change the world. This is how we change the world. So virya is one of the six perfections of a bodhisattva. And a bodhisattva is someone who dedicates themselves to the attainment of enlightenment for all beings. But they don't sort of wait till they're enlightened. It's like while they're practicing, you know, they're giving this energy into the world. And actually, if we have the energy to give, we practice ourselves, that changes us. We step out into this garden of birth and death, that changes the world. That is what the spiritual life is like. That wasn't in the notes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this Vajra seeing, part of the engagement and part of this clear seeing, direct seeing that goes with the withdrawal, is also with impermanence. We can see these endings and death, but we can also see potential in every situation. In every situation, in every refugee camp, in every terrible mental little twist we get ourselves into, there is always that potential that is going to change. In fact, it's inevitable that it's going to change. It's, you know, it would be impossible for it to stay exactly the way it is. And it is possible for it to change for the better. And that is something else that Vajrapani brings. Okay, energy and effort. Last bit. So, I just find this relationship between energy and effort quite interesting, because I think in the West we can have this very, very driven, determined energy that we use in things like our education. Going to get top grades, we're going to get a good career, we're going to achieve this in our lives, we're going to marry the right person, we're going to have this perfect job. And it is energy. It's driven, it's very often harsh, and most of all, it's usually unkind. And that unkindness can come out towards others, but a lot of the time it comes out towards ourselves, as in, we haven't achieved enough, we're not good enough. And, you know, that can be what happens. And that this is, I'm telling you what I was like, basically. And when I started meditating, I just took this grid of achievement and I dropped it straight over the top of the spiritual life and meditation. And it took me a solitary retreat where I had to go to the depths of a pit of misery to realise that this is what I was doing. And I realised that I'd set up particular mental states as things to achieve. And I was practising with this very sort of driven energy. That is not what Vajrapani is getting at. However, this, if we are that kind of person, that can lead to a bit of a fear of really engaging our energies, because it's like we fear that if we really let our determination rip, we're going to be back in that place where we're just doing this sort of driven thing like that, and it's basically where it leads is burnout, and that's not a good idea. However, it doesn't have to be like that. The other fear we can have with regard to relaxation is that if we relax too much and we just sort of let everything go, nothing will happen. We'll just sort of float about, and we, you know, we won't achieve anything, we won't get there, we won't, you know, whatever. And in a way, it's like both of them are true. It's like if we're very driven about something, then that is a sort of harsh, unkind energy that will lead to a dead end. And if we do just float about thinking, oh, well, things will just drop away, the spiritual life will do itself, actually, nothing very much will happen. But it's sort of like, can we do something in the middle? There's a lovely image from the Pali Canon about holding a quail. So if we hold the bird too tight, we crush its rib cage. And if we hold our spiritual life too tight, we'll squash it. If we hold the quail too loosely, the quail will fly away. And if we hold our spiritual life too loosely, if we don't put enough energy in, we won't have a spiritual life to worry about. So we can think that the way to go is to balance our energies, to hold the quail neither too tight nor too loose. And in a way, that is true, and all we can do is balance our energy, and sort of like we're trying to engage with the energy we've got, and we're trying to relax as much as we can. But actually, it's not like that. We want to be holding our quails with a total determination that we are going to move towards awakening, and our life is going to benefit others and allow them to move towards awakening. And we want all our energies, you know, that warrior energy of Vajrapani saying, this is what I am doing in my life. And this, I'm going to be expressing this no matter what my activities are. That is what I'm going to be expressing. And we want to have total relaxation and playfulness and letting go at the same time. And that is what the Buddha worked out how to do when he was, you know, in that sort of, how am I going to do this? And then he sits under the tree. That is what he works out how to do. And how we do that is we intensify our sense of withdrawal and we intensify our sense of wanting to engage. And then those two things, that sort of energy of total determination and the complete letting go and relaxation, just fuse. And then we do have that complete, smooth, totally powerful energy, like this massive river with a really powerful current that's just going in one direction, totally smoothly, totally spontaneous. So, I think we'll just finish with the last words of the Buddha before he died. With mindfulness, strive on.